Hello, and welcome to Switchblade Sisters, the podcast where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic Katie Walsh, filling in for April Wolfe, who has been out of town writing the remake of Black Christmas. I don't know if we can talk about that on the podcast. If we can't, just cut it out, but very exciting news. But each week here on the podcast, we invite a new female filmmaker, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their favorite genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. Today, I'm so excited to have filmmaker Allison Anders here in the studio. Allison, welcome to Switchblade Sisters.
Oh my God, thank you so much. I'm so excited to
Yay,
be here.
This is going to be a super fun conversation.
Can't wait.
So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Allison. Allison Anders is an award-winning screenwriter, film, and television director who was born in Kentucky and raised in L.A. She attended film school at UCLA, where she co-directed the 1987 feature film Border Radio. Her first solo feature, starring Firuza Balk and Ione Skye, Gas Food Lodging, premiered at Sundance in 1992 and earned her Independent Spirit Award nominations for Best Director and Best Screenplay. She went on to write and direct the feature films Mi Vida Loca, Grace of My Heart, and Sugartown, as well as Things Behind the Sun, for which she won a Peabody Award. She's directed episodes of Sex and the City, Orange is the New Black, Southland, Riverdale, Murder in the First, and recently Sorry for Your Loss. And she was nominated for an Emmy for Best Director for the Lifetime movie Ring of Fire. She is a distinguished professor of film at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Today, Allison has chosen the 1961 film Night Tide, starring Dennis Hopper, directed by Curtis Harrington.
Da-da-da!
Da-da-da-da! So, Allison, why did you choose Night Tide?
Oh, my God. I have loved this movie since I was a child.
Oh, wow.
And my mother loved the movie as well. And, you know, it's interesting because it stuck with me just as powerfully as when I first saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I probably saw it on TV. I didn't see it in the theater till I was grown up. But I saw it. I saw it on TV. There was a lot of movies that I could see on TV then. The horror shows, Chiller and stuff like that in Kentucky. So I probably saw this around 63.
Oh, wow.
Night TV with my cousins. So
that's so cool. I mean, it's so funny because it is like a thriller, like horror. They describe Harrington as a horror director, but this film is so dreamy and romantic and like supernatural-ish to me.
Yes.
I'm like, it's not that scary, but, you know, it's kind of got like a vibe.
And it's got mood, which mm-hmm. is what I find a lot of horror lacks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not interesting to me usually because mm-hmm. it lacks the atmosphere that, the budget constraints end up, you know, requiring you to have, like Carnival of Souls mm-hmm. or, you know, a lot of the AIP Edgar Allan Poe movies and, you know, even later the Hammer horror films, you know. It's just I find that people go for gore and noise rather than silence and mood, you know.
Yeah. And there's a real sense of place.
Yes.
So there are a lot of location shooting.
Very much.
Yeah.
Which blows my mind because people sometimes, I was looking at some stuff people had written about this movie, and they call it the Venice Boardwalk. It was not the Venice Boardwalk. As we know, it was the Santa Monica Pier. And so it was, it was that pier with the merry-go-round and all the stuff that we recognize or don't mm-hmm. that's now gone. And then there's all the shooting in Venice when it was, I mean, there's those chickens walking around and, it's like it was a really downbeat place.
Right.
And it's interesting that Dennis Hopper ended up so connected to Venice.
Right.
Because he ended up, of course, living there, dying there, buying all the art from the Venice, artists there. So it's kind of amazing. He even did a piece of, you know, Venice graffiti himself, an art piece. So Venice was really important to him.
Yeah.
But it was really, it was like those canals were rancid at the time, and the bridges were falling down. And
yeah, it definitely has like that rough, you know, seaside town, amusement park.
Yes.
You know, it's not glamorous in any way, which
not
is obviously so different from the Venice we know now. I'm going to give a quick intro to Night Tide, just a quick rundown of the plot. So spoiler alert for those who haven't seen Night Tide, today's episode will contain spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. Like April always says, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause this episode and go watch Night Tide, now is your chance. So, Night Tide is a 1961 thriller written and directed by Curtis Harrington, distributed by American Independent Pictures. Dennis Hopper stars as Johnny, a naive young seaman on leave from the Navy in, well, I think this in Wikipedia they said San Diego, but it's obviously Santa Monica and Venice. He meets a beautiful woman, Maura, Linda Lawson, at a jazz club and pursues her, even though she's been being followed by a very mysterious and intimidating older woman, played by Marjorie Cameron, who we have to discuss further later. We will get into Marjorie Cameron. Maura invites him to her apartment above the merry-go-round on the boardwalk and serves him mackerel for breakfast while petting a seagull and telling him that she works as a mermaid in one of the local sideshow attractions.
Indeed.
For a fellow named Captain Murdoch, who's like a father figure to her.
I'm a mermaid.
You're a what?
A mermaid. Half woman, half fish.
I don't get it.
Oh, it's very simple. I wear an artificial fish tail, and I lie in a tank that looks like it's filled with water. And people pay 25 cents and come and look at me. And that's how I make my living.
Johnny and Maura fall in love. They have some beach makeouts, all kinds of fun stuff, some little bonfire dance parties.
Mm-hmm.
But Johnny has been warned about the dangers of dating Maura by the merry-go-round operator, his daughter, and the local fortune teller.
In the past 2 years, Maura's had two boyfriends, and they're both dead now.
Well, do the police think that had something to do with her?
Nothing's been proved.
No, not yet. But don't you think the fact that it's happened twice is enough? They were both nice boys. They went around with her. Then suddenly, they disappear.
And there is a rumor that she is a real mermaid, a siren, who lures men to their deaths. Maura confesses to Johnny that she is a siren and that the mysterious woman in black is one of the sea people calling her back to the ocean.
You saw how she looked at me, how she spoke to me. She's one of them. She's one of the sea people, and she's here to remind me of the time that I must go to them in the sea.
Nevertheless, Johnny persists. One afternoon, she invites him scuba diving, where she cuts off his air tank underwater. He bursts to the surface, and she swims away, disappears into the deep ocean. So after he escapes, he's troubled by nightmares. He's searching for her. He goes to the mermaid attraction, where he finds her lifeless body floating in the mermaid tank. He confronts Murdoch, and the captain ultimately confesses to the police that it was he who killed Maura's ex-boyfriends and convinced her that she was a mermaid in order to keep her all to himself.
Eventually, my love wasn't enough for her. She had to have another kind of love. And when she began those relationships, I decided the only thing to do was to cut them off at their source. So I killed those two young men. And I tried to persuade her in some way that she had done it, under some strange influence from the sea people.
Johnny leaves, but not before goodbye to his new friend, the merry-go-round operator's daughter, played by Luana Anders, whom he promises to visit sometime. Gosh, what a movie. Falling in love with a mermaid.
I know. And it's funny because usually, you know, falling in love with a mermaid is a cute, funny thing, you know, or even like, you know, How to Stuff a Wild Bikini. You know, there was like the bikini running, you know, and there was a mermaid in that movie, I believe, as well, or in one of those beach party movies. But this is like a really dark.
Mermaids are scary.
Yeah, mermaids are scary mythology. Mm-hmm. And Curtis Harrington, of all people, would know that.
Yes, you know? He would. He loves myth and
yes.
Edgar Allan Poe and
exactly.
the surreal. And he was associated with these like occultists. And, you know, he's really into this kind of like dreamy, magical type of aesthetic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I... it's something that I responded to really well, even as a child. I mean, if I think about the two films, the two horror films that really affected me, apart from the AIP, like mm-hmm. I said, the Edgar Allan Poe movies that they did, it was this one and it was Carnival of Souls. Mm-hmm. And they both have this very low budget. You know, they had no money to make these, but had this very... moody, and both of them had this kind of carnival, you know, yeah. aspect to them.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of Harrington's later films, which he made for Universal in the 70s, was Games
yes.
with Simone Signoret, and that was like yes. also sort of a carnival vibe.
Yeah.
So it's like he draws out these themes from this aesthetic and this world that's kind of fun. But there's something sinister.
Exactly. Yeah. There's something underneath it.
Like, you should be having fun. This yeah. is an amusement boardwalk.
Right.
One thing I wanted to say was that this movie was very much influenced by Cat People.
Yes.
The Val Lewton film. Well, he produced it. It was directed by Jacques Tourneur, which, again, woman turns into a cat. Maybe
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
such an influential horror movie, RKO, and same kind of atmosphere, same kind
yes.
of tone and mood of like, is she or isn't she, you know, and not a ton of horror, but a lot of suspense.
Right.
And Cat People is where we get the like the horror movie trope, the Lewton bus, where,
right.
you know, the bus screeches into frame and you think it's an actual scream, but it's like something else. And that's like the original jump scare.
Right, right, right. Totally, yeah. totally. And that's the thing, too. I think that it's because that was another one that I saw as a child,
mm-hmm.
along with these other two. And again, it's that idea of like silence, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and not showing and shadow and mood mm-hmm. and atmosphere. And also, I think in both of these movies and probably in Carnival of Souls, too, it's driven by female, you know, the mystery is the female, you know, and it's and also it's female desire is the scary element.
Right. Female sexuality
yeah.
is the problem.
Yeah. It's like really alluring and really terrifying.
Yeah.
She might kill you.
It's
yeah.
interesting. There are a lot. Harrington's films, which I'm not that familiar with, but having gone through his filmography, a lot of scary women.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. For sure.
I loved, you know, going through his filmography and all. He made all these like weird TV movies in the 70s with like Shelley Winters
oh, yeah.
that were adaptations of Hansel and Gretel stories with, you know, this terrifying woman and these children. And you know, he worked with Gloria Swanson and Simone Signoret, and he knew all these amazing grand dames
yeah.
of Hollywood. I mean, he knew everyone. He's got the most interesting life.
I was so bummed out that when I was watching the little documentary on him, I was like, oh, God, why didn't I meet this guy?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, he probably just was too weird for Hollywood. And then he probably just, you know, didn't have any money. And then you find out, oh, he had this whole other chapter in his life directing massive TV. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, he has the most fascinating career because he starts out making experimental films.
Yes.
He's hanging out with Maya Darren in Europe
yeah.
And Kenneth Anger. He's appearing in Kenneth Anger films. He's writing for Cahiers du Cinéma. He comes back to America. He's working for Roger Corman in AIP.
Yes, yes.
Makes a couple studio pictures, makes all these bizarre TV movies. Then he directs Dynasty and Charlie's Angels. It's like,
I know.
Total
I know.
Independent yeah. underground filmmaker. Then makes his way into, you know, more mainstream stuff. I mean, honestly, it kind of sounds like your career, too. Going from these underground films and independent films, like Border Radio.
Right.
And now you're doing all of this television work, which is
right.
so interesting. I mean, you know, as a director, do you feel like you are able to kind of bring your point of view to working on stuff like TV? That's kind of where you're a little bit more of a hired gun.
No.
Oh, okay.
And it's kind of great because, you know, watching that documentary, he kind of says as much as well.
Yeah, and he's like, oh,
and
it's
in fact, yeah, and you can't put your, if you're putting your thumbprint on it, you're not serving. Mm-hmm. You're not doing your job.
Yeah.
Because your job is really to, I mean, I kind of, the very first TV that I did was Sex and the City. And my first episode, well, there were two back to back, and I was kind of, you know, I was kind of had anxiety over how to approach this, mm-hmm. you know, because I knew it was, I was already realizing it was so different from making my own movies. And then I finally got it, that I was more like the foster mother. You know, this isn't my baby. I can nurture this along and maybe leave a little part of myself. And then it goes on to the next,
it's
you know,
got to be an interesting
foster mother.
Yeah, you know. It's probably a different way to stretch your creative brain to, instead of be spilling your own guts in your own independent yeah. films, you are figuring out how to shepherd this project that is sort of larger than just you or your point of view, your aesthetic.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that in the best cases, funny enough, it was more on, you know, I worked really well on, you know, a couple of cop shows, you mm-hmm. know, Southland, Murder in the First, where I could take on things and learn certain things that I would. Look, I learned something on every single thing that I work on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of amazing thing, is that you learn new stuff, and that's how you've got to approach it. You've got to approach it, okay, so in this show I can learn how to do a car chase.
Yeah.
You know,
that's super fun.
Yeah. That's really fun. Thank you, Southlands. Thank you, Chris Chulock, for telling me when I came to you and said, there's a car chase in the script. I don't know how to do that. And he says, that's okay, I'm gonna teach you.
That's amazing. I love that.
So that's really fun. That's super fun.
Going back to Curtis Harrington,
mm-hmm.
He was a child obsessed with movies. And
yes.
It sounds like you watched a lot of movies as well as a kid. He talks about seeing a billboard of Bride and Frankenstein that really captured his attention, and then seeing this Boris Karloff movie that like had this huge effect on him. But he ended up becoming friends with James Whale mm-hmm. at a screening of Bride of mm-hmm. Frankenstein. And, you know, he had some really interesting mentors, Joseph von Sternberg, James Whale. Have you ever had that kind of relationship with a filmmaker that you were a huge fan of, that you like, they became maybe a friend or a mentor?
Oh, yes. Wim Wenders was the first.
Wow.
So I basically, recently, he says, let's face it, you stalked me, Allison. You really stalked me. And I did for like a year.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, because I called him up. I got his phone number, called information, because I had sent him a fan letter.
Oh, wow.
I saw Lightning Over Water, his movie that was sort of a documentary, sort of not. It was an odd one, but I was really... I was completely inspired by it. There was something very raw about it, and I was in—I wasn't in film school yet. I hadn't gone to UCLA yet, but I had applied, so I was heading in this direction as a filmmaker, hopefully. So I wrote him a fan letter and sent him a mixtape
oh, wow.
of girl group music, and people were like, that's really weird to do that. He's a director. And I was like, no, but he's cool. He's not like most directors. He's cool. You know, I know from his movies, he likes music. He's cool. So, because directors were not terribly cool at that point in the world.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, they were kind of old guys.
Okay.
You know, they were a bunch of old guys is how most people saw it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he was not old. He was young and he was groovy, you know. So I sent it to his agent, and then I, after a week, I hadn't heard back from him. So I called the agency and I said, did you get the letter? And they go, oh, we probably forwarded it him to him. We would have forwarded that to him to his house in New York. And I was like, oh, New York, huh? So I called information.
Operator.
Yeah, totally. And he was listed. Who could imagine that? He was listed in the phone book. So I call him up. I called my boyfriend at the time, Kurt Voss, who I made Border Radio with. And I go, oh, my God. I've got his phone number. And he goes, oh, Jesus. And I go, what am I going to do? And he goes, well, you're going to have to call him. So I called him up and I go, hi, is this Vim Vendors?
Oh, my gosh.
He was like, well. And I said, oh, hi, I'm Allison Anders. I sent you this letter. And he goes, oh, yes, the big one. So we talked for a little while. He was like sitting around watching football on TV.
Oh,
and
funny.
He goes, he says, thank you for the girl group tape. There was stuff that I had never heard on there before.
Cool, Allison.
Woohoo! So then he says, this is what set everything in motion. He goes, well, Allison, I don't write letters very much, but if you want to keep writing to me, you can.
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, should I send it to your agent? And he says, no, send it to my house. And he gave me his address.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
So, you know, so then I got into UCLA and then within that first year, he was starting to work on Paris, Texas. And so he called me up one day and he says, Allison, it's Vim. I'm coming to Los Angeles. I wonder if you could find time to show me your film.
Oh, wow. That's so
cool. I showed him my first little movie. He came to UCLA and I presented him with the fact that I had won this grant. And he said, oh, congratulations. And I said, yeah, it's to study under you on Paris, Texas.
It's the inaugural Vim Vendors Production Assistant Award.
Because I had lied my ass off and said he had invited me.
Oh, I see.
And so I won this grant.
Nice.
But then meanwhile, my two other friends had won it too. So he had to take all three.
Oh, my gosh.
So he's like, I guess you have to come.
Oh, my gosh.
So on that film, he had me run lines with Harry Dean Stanton and Dean Stockwell.
Wow.
So I had never known what actors go through or, you know. And so in doing that, I had, you know, Harry was trying to figure out an approach to the character of Travis being a mute. And he says, I don't know what's going on in his head. Is he catatonic? Is he, you know? And I said, I was catatonic once when I was 15, and I wrote and him and Dean Stockwell looked at me and they were just like, you know, kind of go on. And I was like, I wrote a poem about it. And they look at each other and Dean Stockwell goes, honey, do you happen to have that poem here? And I said, I do. And we were in Texas. I don't know why I brought it with me, but that, and then they just kind of grilled me about it. And to his dying day, bless him, Harry always said that I helped him create that character.
Wow.
And create that approach. So I never knew that my own personal experience could be given to an actor as an approach.
That's incredible.
So that's like, I mean, what all Vim did for me with that experience was insane.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What a story.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a really quick break. And when we come back, we will talk more Night Tide. Maybe we'll get more good stories out of Allison. So come on back.
Hey, Max Fun listeners. Have you been listening to Max Fun for a while and you've just been wondering, where's the new Flat Earth podcast I keep hearing about?
Well, here it is. We give you all the facts on NASA's lies and how we know that the Earth is actually flat. Just kidding. This is Oh No, Ross and Carrie, and we join fringe religious groups. We undergo alternative medical treatments.
And we hang out with people like 9/11 truthers, flat earthers. We find out, why do people believe strange things?
We join them, and we tell you all about it. We have a lot of fun. We make a lot of friends.
Yeah, we do. We joined the Mormons. We joined the Scientologists. We got acupunctured. We got fire cupped. We got ear candled. We've done it all, and we're going to keep doing it all. Why don't you check out Oh No, Ross and Carrie at MaximumFun.org.
All right, welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm Katie Walsh. I'm talking to Allison Anders about Night Tide, an amazing 1961 film starring the hunky Dennis Hopper.
Oh, God. Yeah, we got to talk about Dennis.
We do have to talk about Dennis. Curtis Harrington said that Dennis had met him at a coffee shop watching some of his experimental shorts, and then he just gave him the script and said, do you want to be in it? And he agreed, which is, you know, a huge coup kind of for Curtis because this was his first film. And Dennis Hopper had already been a giant.
Right.
Dennis Hopper has had the longest career the longest career. I mean, from 1954 to, you know, his death. It's
right.
Incredible. But he is absolute gorgeous beefcake in this. In his sailor suit.
He is so beautiful in
it. I know.
Everyone will fall in love. And he's sweet.
He is. You don't
he's
expect.
Sweet.
He got, you know, he became such a bad guy in his later film roles. Or, you know, that's what he was known for. You know,
right.
Blue Velvet. I associated him with Speed.
Right.
But he is so earnest and sincere. He's truly like a naive young man who just doesn't know what he's getting into. And he's entirely convincing.
Yes. He's beautiful. And he was very, he was just a sweet guy, too, in Giant. He was the sort of the sensitive son. And we get to see all of that beauty in him,
mm-hmm.
Just both physically and just his vulnerability.
Yeah, he has a very sweet spirit, and he never turns dark.
No, never.
You know, he remains open and loving, and you know, she's like, I'm a siren. I'm going to lure you to your death, and he's like, cool. Like,
yeah.
Let's stay dating. I will go scuba diving with you.
It's so true. It's so true. Let's stay dating. You're so hot.
I know. But, I mean, all of the beauty shots in this movie are of Dennis.
For sure. For sure.
The scene where they're, you know, making out on the couch and he sees the mermaid tail and the octopus tentacles.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, he's the one that Harrington is shooting, like, you know, the babe.
For sure.
He gets
for
all the
sure.
beauty shots.
He
yeah.
does. He does.
Sorry, and I just had to have a tangent about Dennis Hopper.
He's just so beautiful.
Yeah. This film sort of bridging almost this like 1950s style and then what's coming next.
Totally.
Probably because Harrington had that European influence on his films and doing experimental films and things like that. But it just seems so much more, like we were talking about atmosphere, mood,
mm-hmm.
place, location shooting. Everything
yes.
seems very authentic, even though it is this fantastical story.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think makes it that it's so grounded
yeah.
that you're invested immediately. Like I was looking even at the opening. You see Dennis Hopper walking along the pier there, and he goes and he takes, you know, there's probably, you know, I'm sure that all those people walking by in the frame past him, that's, he just let the camera go.
Yeah.
Those were not extras. And then he goes and he takes his photo booth pictures, which
yeah.
by the way, I have tons of photo booth pictures that me and my children took on that pier.
Oh, wow.
You know,
yeah.
at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so, you know, it's just kind of, I think that's you're instantly grounded in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it works even to this day. You can look at that movie and go, I'm settled into this already.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of brilliant filmmaking.
That seems like something that you do in your films as well, especially with like Mi Vida Loca, which takes place in Echo Park. You used real people.
Yeah.
You know, is that important to you to shoot on location, to get that sense of groundedness in a real place?
I love that. In fact, I love shooting. I'd rather create a set on another set. Mm-hmm. Rather than created on a sound stage.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something fun about working on some of those old sound stages. I mean, for sure. You look up in the rafters and you go, oh, my God, Betty Davis sat here looking up, wondering where's my next cigarette, you know?
Yeah. There's a sense of history.
Yeah. And, you know, there's something wonderful about going, oh, we can just put a hook in a street lamp right here, you know, on this street, and it'll turn on magically, you know, But the accidents that happen with shooting on location, you can't get those, mm-hmm. you know. And unfortunately, accidents are, scary to the powers that be. So lawyers and so forth. So you really, you know, those beautiful accidents mm-hmm. happen far more with very low budget films and with guerrilla filmmaking. So you can get that sort of raw sense that you just don't get otherwise. I mean, there's one moment I was noticing, like, he's walking by on the boardwalk and there's some little kid in the foreground and they're like looking off this way. And I'm sure a mother said, get out of the shot, you know, but it looks so real, you know, it was just, I don't know. There's something beautiful about it. And then you get a sense of the character. You get a sense of place, but you get a sense of the character anchored in that place, mm-hmm. which I think is really key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get a real sense of his bright-eyed newness.
Yes.
He's so in love with this place that's so exotic and foreign to him. He keeps being like, I'm from Denver.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's gone, but here I am. I'm from Denver. And
you know, it's like he's never seen the ocean before. Yeah. I mean, he has. He's in the Navy. But he's like, this is such a new place. And you can see him taking it all in.
Yes.
When he goes to the jazz club as well. It's such a cool scene. I wanted to mention that Curtis Harrington once said that was the most difficult scene for him to shoot because there were all these extras and he had to manage the band. And he said that the flute player was famous and he had to manage this famous flute player. And he had to manage Marjorie Cameron, the amazing woman.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've shot like music scenes. Things Behind the Sun is about a woman in a rock band and Sugartown. So what is your approach to shooting music, live music scenes?
Wow. Well, it's really pretty fun. I mean, it's, I've done it so many different ways. One of the ways is that I approach certain scenes with like, what have I seen where it really looked fake?
Yeah.
You know, and then I go, why did it look so fake? And so I, you know, in Things Behind the Sun, I really had to strip things down because I had to make sure that, first of all, that the actors that I cast, well, the actress that I cast.
Kim Dickens.
Which, thank God, I had the wonderful Kim Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
Oof. And, you know, Kim treated that guitar like it was part of her body. And I think that that's really the key, is that you've got to see somebody, you know, embody what a musician is, that this is like part of me, this instrument. And it can look really cheesy if that's not accurate.
Yeah, if they're just sort of handling it weird and I've never touched a guitar before.
Exactly, yeah. And they just don't know, or they overperform on stage, you know, for what the scene's called for. Now, some, you know, in Grace of My Heart, things could be a bit more mannered in some of the performances. early on in the 50s. Mm-hmm. But then when we got to the 60s, it had to be a little, you know, off the cuff, you know, so it couldn't be. So you just have to go with the style of the music and the style of performance. And then you also have to do that with audience.
Yeah.
Like you can't, like people inevitably, like, you know, a lot of first ADs will rev up the crowd so that they're overreacting, you know, in a way that that crowd would not do in a million years, you know. And again, that's Wim Wenders, you know, when I think about Wings of Desire, it's still one of my favorite on stage performances of both Crime in the City Solution and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, where you've got a really, the audience feels real. They're, you know, some people are like moving, some people are just staring, some people are stoned, you know, some people are, you know, looking at someone else. I mean, it's kind of what happens when you're in a performance or you're mesmerized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that all of that plays into the vibe.
Right.
Because it's a vibe. It's not just the performance of the music.
Yeah, you have
to
get everyone to...
Yeah, and the storytelling is still going on. Yeah. And everybody's got to be in sync.
Right. Like you can't like you were saying about the extras, if they're too amped up but it's not appropriate to the scene, then it's like, why are they so excited?
Exactly. Yeah. Right? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Another great one is Blow Up, where, you know, where the Yardbirds are playing and there's that one chick, that famous model at the time, I can't remember her name, but she's off dancing with a guy, but everybody else is just standing there, and then they all go nuts when Jeff Beck breaks his guitar up and throws it into the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
They finally come alive at that moment.
You're like, that's actually authentic.
Yeah. That's superb. That's great storytelling. So I think that that's the other thing, is you've got to keep the story going. You can't stop for the music.
Just for the musical performance.
And that happens in this movie where he walks into that jazz club. So it's like, ooh, this is a, I'm walking down the stairs into this unknown.
Yeah.
And there's the jazz band and there's the interesting couples sitting around and
you really get a sense of how cool it is.
Yes, totally. Yeah. Totally. And it doesn't, you know, a lot of things during that time could look really phony beatnik, but this one looked really real.
Yeah, and the music's good. I'm famous flute player. I have no idea who he is.
I know, that famous flute player.
There are a lot of close-ups of him, though.
Yeah. And then she's reacting to the music in a really odd way. So you instantly go, okay, this girl is, she's off fucking beat. She really is. Because she's got a weird way of moving, and but yet she's got no expression on her face. And and he can't tell. He's mesmerized by her, but he can't tell if she wants him near her or doesn't want him near her. Yeah.
Well, we are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Marjorie Cameron.
Oh, yes, we are.
Because I just need to talk about her.
I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the host of
Everything's Coming Up Simpsons.
Every episode, we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright.
I got a D minus, I passed!
And we've also had people that are on the Max Fun Network already.
We've had Weird Al Yankovic on the show.
I was just struck by how sharp the writing is. I mean, that's no surprise because it's The Simpsons, but I mean, like, you can't say that about a lot of TV shows, particularly ones that at that point had been on the air for 14 years.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, smell you later.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm Katie Walsh. I'm talking to Allison Anders about Night Tide. And I keep talking about Marjorie Cameron, who plays the creepy sea woman. She has had a crazy life. Everyone just go read her Wikipedia entry. It is a insane journey through the sex cults of Pasadena in the 1940s. Yes. She was married to Jack Parsons, who was roommates with L. Ron Hubbard, who believes that he manifested her through a ritual. And then he 10 years later, accidentally blew himself up while making home explosives.
Yes, yes.
But Marjorie Cameron was this like amazing woman. She was also a painter, an artist. She started her own cult in Riverside for a little bit.
That was fascinating, yeah. Isn't it?
And then in her old age got arrested for growing marijuana in her home. So please go research everything. Read everything you can about Marjorie Cameron. But Harrington was friends with her. He, you know, was friends with Kenneth Anger, mm-hmm. who was associated with Thelema, which was the Aleister Crowley occultist group,
yes.
and that she was in. But he said, "I cast her in Night Tide because of her on-screen presence. I needed someone with that quality, and she had it. It's not easy to find. Casting Marjorie Cameron is an example of selecting someone for their presence and their soul, not because they've been in acting class half their lives." So I wanted to talk to you about, you know, casting and working with actors and, you know, what you look for when you're casting someone.
Well, God, I may say again, after my own heart, this guy, because
right.
it's just like, you know, you know, as a result of him having that instinct, he gives us this person on screen that was really important to the L.A. avant-garde.
Mm-hmm.
And here she is, you
right.
know, as a result, we thank God get to see her in these in this movie. And she was also in Kenneth Anger's, one of Kenneth Anger's movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that there's something, I love working with non-actors. I mean, when I first started, when I was in film school, I was like, why do these movies look so weird? Like, what is wrong here? It's like the film school world of acting. And I thought they are just over-directed
mm-hmm.
and they're cast wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're not cast for the part and they're over-directed and probably the script is overwritten
mm-hmm.
and they're having to push themselves into this world and they're not very good actors yet because they haven't done enough. So you've got to get, you know, I started to learn very early on that you've got to give people a lot of room. And whether they think they're an actor at that stage or whether they're just somebody that's in a band or someone that's just got a great presence. And I've continued to work like that. I mean, I've worked with great, great professional actors. But I inevitably, especially if music is involved, I will cast non-acting mm-hmm. musicians with the actors. But I also, on Mi Vida Loca, I cast gang members with
right.
the actors.
And how did you find them?
Well, I found them long before there was a script, because I moved into Echo Park and I used to see them walking down the street and I would quickly move to the other side of the road because
mm-hmm.
they were really badass, intense, scary girls.
Yeah.
So.
And you were like, I need to make a movie about them.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, okay, they scare the shit out of me. I got to get to know them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, that's so cool.
Yeah. So, you know, when it came time to make the movie, God love my producers, Colin Callender and Carrie Putnam at HBO, because they backed me up on casting gang members alongside new actors.
Yeah.
You know, these actors, even Danny Trejo and Jesse Borrego, who were my most, who were the two actors in the film that had the most experience, were still not very well known at that point.
I mean, Salma Hayek is in that movie. Like, you have all these people.
Her first movie.
That's crazy.
She owes me.
Yes.
Salma, you owe me.
I mean, you have really an eye. I was rewatching Gas, Food, Lodging, and I'm like, this cast is insane.
Oh, God, thank
you. Know,
you.
Even, and that's like Firuza. I mean, she'd been working since she was a child, but.
Right.
Pre a lot of her bigger roles,
yes.
That we have come to know her for, but she has such a presence on screen.
She really does.
Even Chris Mulkey has
oh,
such
yes.
a great presence.
I love him.
That cast is just outrageously good.
I love them all
yeah.
so much. I love them. I mean, I really love working with actors.
Right.
Anytime that I think, oh, I could just write now. I don't need to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I just go, but
Well, it sounds like you got such an interesting and, you know, education working with Harry Dean Stanton and Wim Wenders on Paris, Texas. And like that moment of sharing sounds so profound and like you can't give that up in a way.
No, no, you really, it was really something to kind of, you know, it's really a matter of what's beautiful about it is that it's an intimate relationship that's only for a specific purpose and a specific amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I came to know that, and you have to win trust very quickly, especially on episodic. I mean, you have to go in there and kind of like, you know, mm-hmm. win trust with the actors. Not easy thing to do, mm-hmm. you know, so that you can get the best out of them and so that they can feel protected, that you're going to protect them. And then sometimes you have, you know, on episodic, it's hard because you have to protect them even kind of at odds with what else is going on with, mm-hmm. you know, with people that have hired you to do it. So, but on my films, I can certainly, that's my job completely. Yeah. And if I ever have a situation where actors don't trust me, that's really painful. Mm-hmm. That's painful for me and it's painful for them.
Yeah.
And often that doesn't, I mean, the only times that that's really happened to me on stuff on my films is where for some reason, I didn't cast the, I cast the person, but I kind of had to, you know, so, and it's not that I resent it. It's usually that I've said, okay, but probably if I had had that opportunity to sit with them, I probably would have thought, I don't know that he or she's going to trust me to do this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also, something about Curtis Harrington is people sort of said that he was like this, he was able to work with all these quote unquote difficult women.
Right.
Like Shelley Winters, who I didn't realize.
Can you imagine? Yeah. Whoa.
And so he must have created a real sense of trust and.
You can see it.
Yeah.
You can see it in this movie.
Yeah.
That everyone's just kind of like given it up for him.
Right. And at the fact that this is his first movie, too, it's such an assured debut.
Yeah.
But. What's interesting, Linda Lawson, who plays Maura, she never really went on to do any. She kind of just went off and became a housewife.
Right.
She's so beautiful and she's really great in the role. But she kind of just was like, no, I guess acting's not for me.
Yeah. And she was a singer
mm-hmm.
and she and her husband was quite a successful producer, produced Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
okay.
Kid.
Yeah,
and,
heard of
know.
It.
Yeah. But she, but here's something kind of crazy. So as much as I love this movie, mm-hmm. as you know, so then by this time when I was making films, I was seeing, or even before I was in film school, I could go see Night Tide at the New Art or at the New Beverly. Mm-hmm. It would play all the time.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a cult fave. And so, so cut to around 2007, I, thank you, Rosanna Arquette, God bless you, and Dana, for getting me onto the show called What About Brian? And so I directed an episode of that, and there was an actress that was part of the cast, and it was a relationship show about all these different families. It was really ahead of its time. All these different families in young families in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian is a guy that's single. And they're all married up and have kids. And
I feel like I've seen this show.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really
good. I remember
good.
Liking it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really terrific and beautifully written. And and so this one amazing actress, Amanda Foreman, is in the movie. It was in the show, part of the regular cast. And I really loved working with her because she was extremely professional. She was completely unneurotic. She was completely unneedy. She just kind of, she didn't even have to trust me because she just did the work. You know, she mm-hmm. was just, and she was so easy to direct and she was so likable. And lo and behold, I find out later, she's Linda Lawson's daughter.
Oh, my God.
Son of a bitch. I wish I had, like, gone, come on, now tell me. So does she have any, did she save anything from Night Tide, a little shell or something?
Yeah. Oh, my God. That is so crazy. This movie is, like, important in your life. It keeps
it
coming
really,
back.
It really, really is.
From seeing it on late night TV as a
right?
kid to working with the daughter of...
It's so insane.
I feel like it is weirdly imprinted on you and your career. Because I'm finding so many parallels with you and Curtis.
I know. It's kind of crazy that yeah. I never met him. And I was so pissed thinking, oh, God, I wish I had met him. And, you know, why didn't I seek him out? You know, like I did Vim. You know,
yeah.
why didn't I go seek him out? And... you know, and then, yeah, he was somebody really important.
He was important.
To me.
And I think to you, mm-hmm. I think, and, you know, his approach, the things that come out of his films, you know, the authenticity, the groundedness, the performances, the cast and their presence. I think that's all apparent in your work as well.
Oh, thank you.
So whether or not he was an influence, it sort of like seeped in.
It really did.
But he's also just such a fast. I mean, I had never heard of him before we started talking about this movie. And now I'm like obsessed in the Curtis Harrington
right?
rabbit hole. I'm like,
totally.
I must find every British television movie that he made in 1975.
Totally.
But he's such a fascinating representation of 20th century cinema.
Oh,
with
he really
the scope of people that he knew and that he was associated with. And I mean, there's so many interviews where he's just talking about Joseph von Sternberg and
right.
and James Whale. And he was an advisor on Gods and Monsters, which is the film about James
yes.
Whale. So he's a really important figure, but someone who like was kind of overlooked, I think. I don't think a ton of people know about him.
I know.
Yeah.
He really was. And I think it's because he was one of those pioneers who was kind of off on his own in some ways, even
mm-hmm.
though he was really entrenched in the business
mm-hmm.
and he knew everybody.
Right.
But he was still kind of, he wasn't necessarily like part of the AIP
for sure.
stock.
Yeah. And he wasn't like a Coppola, De Palma, like those guys,
right.
Scorsese. But still, you know, such an important figure.
So important.
Thank you.
Thank
you. For letting
you.
Me talk about this movie. Is there anything else we need to say about Night Tide? Any favorite moments that we haven't covered yet?
You know, I really do think that dream sequence is one of the most amazing things to me. When she comes walking out of the bathroom and she's got she's wrapped up.
Yes.
But, you know, we can tell that she's going to get naked with him,
mm-hmm.
or that's what we think is going to happen. But all I can tell you people, you will not believe. And it's kind of crazy and funny, but it's also really weird creepy, too,
it's
in this amazing
sexy,
way. Yes.
It's creepy. It's kind of like... I'm laughing a little bit, but it's also quite sensual and then terrifying.
And then terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's just unbelievable. And
yeah.
I think it's just such a beautiful movie.
Yeah, I mean, he manages to make a film that is dreamy, romantic, sexy, and creepy all at the same time. And it's like, how to hit that tone, I don't know how anyone does it. So he's a master.
Totally. Totally he is. Yay, Curtis Harrington.
Yay.
I'm so glad you got to direct Charlie's Angels and Dynasty so that you made big bucks on residuals back when there were only three networks.
I thank you, Aaron Spelling, for
yes,
hiring Curtis.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, this has been such an interesting, fun chat. I feel like I just want to ask you 10,000 more questions about all your great Hollywood stories. Go back and watch Allison's films if you haven't seen all of them. But thank you so much. This was such a great conversation.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org.
I don't get it.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.